So, maybe a couple announcements. The next homework assignment is posted. It's just actually one problem and an optional extra credit problem. Oh, I didn't see you come in. One thing is I put an example of me scattering resonances in the supplement directory of the online directory. Take a look at that. I'm hoping I'll remember to show an example from that supplement today after we finish the main theory of developing how you treat scattering of electromagnetic waves from spherical objects, which ends up introducing scattering phase shifts just like in quantum mechanics. And I kept saying that, well, this is more complicated than quantum treatment of phase shifts. So I thought maybe I should actually show you how I treat quantum scattering in terms of phase shifts. So I put a subset of my quantum notes from previous AMO lectures in the supplement directory also, a few pages where you see how simple compared to electromagnetic wave scattering, quantum waves scattering is for spinless particles. And so where we kind of stopped, or maybe before I start diving into today's math, we'll finish off today this partial wave scattering treatment, and I hope to show you some examples of me scattering resonances. Then we'll do diffraction theory, which will take us maybe into part of the next lecture after the break. But then we'll do BN relativity, which I think is a fun part of this course. So you might review between now and then if you're looking for something to read over the break, have nothing to do. Could maybe refresh your memory about relativity and all those fun things like time dilation. And then we'll see how it develops in electromagnetic theory. So just to remind you kind of where we stopped, we had just reached this point, I think, that we had written waves. We're describing a scattering experiment, waves coming in to a spherical scatterer of some epsilon and mu, and then we'll have outgoing spherical waves coming out. And so far, we're just describing we've matched to the spherical waves inside, matched to the outside region. And there are going to be only JLs inside because only they are regular at the origin. But outside, you'll have to have two independent solutions you match to. And I gave the equations last time, how you get these AL and BLM, which actually for an exact sphere symmetry, they won't depend on M. In fact, they will only depend on L. And you can rewrite these A and B in terms of a phase shift and an amplitude. And that's useful because actually all the scattering is really controlled just by the phase shifts. And the amplitude will be addressed later, essentially. So you can just basically set, at this point, these capital A's to 1. And then you see why they are called a phase shift, because if you take this would be the phase of a spherical Bessel function at infinity, and the entire effect on the Lth partial wave, like in this case for the TE modes, is to make the wave look phase shifted at large distances. And amazingly, that translates into a quantitative description of the scattering angular distribution, the power radiated, total power radiated, and all those things. So, Let's see how much further we can go. So there are similar expressions for TM modes, and there will be their corresponding phase shifts, delta LTM, etc. These will normally be frequency dependent, partly because the wavelengths are frequency dependent, and that the way that interacts with the size of the sphere is of course going to be wavelength dependent, but also the epsilon and mu can themselves be frequency dependent. So generally, after you've found all these modes, the TM and TE modes and their phase shifts, and usually for wavelengths that are not too short, comparable to the size of the scatterer, maybe even a little smaller, but hopefully not too small, then usually there will be a finite number of L's that matter here. And we can then, once you've found those modes, you can write the general electric field, can be represented as a sum over some constants times these mode fields that are characterized by the phase shifts and by setting this amplitude to one. So let's write some expressions for that. There will be some constant times the TE mode fields another scalar constant times the TM electric field modes. Those same constants will appear times the magnetic field modes. And we can look at these at infinity, or basically in the far zone, what the electric field looks like. That's where we'll have to go in order to, for instance, calculate the cross-section for scattering, the differential cross-section, and the polarization of those waves, and so on. So we'll have a sum over L and M. We'll have the TE coefficients. We'll have the phase shifted Bessel functions with this asymptotic form over KR. And then we'll have the TM component of the electric field. The same constants from up here. And then this curl expression of the phase shifted XLM for the curl term. We'll have a similar expression for H, except now it's the TM mode that has the simple XLM dependence. The phase shifted sine wave in the far zone with the TM phase shift. KR, XLM, and then the curl term comes from the TE mode contribution to H. And there's a constant, I mu naught omega, curl of the sine, blah, 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 times XLM over KR. So the thing is, we found these scatterings, or these spherical solutions, but we haven't yet imposed scattering boundary conditions. That's the next step. In general, you could represent any solutions in this outer region this way, with some choice of these constants. But now we're going to specify the constants that will correspond specifically to this scattering experiment, with waves coming to a detector and an incident plane wave coming in. And that just requires some algebra. And this is one of the steps that's a little messier than with scalar scattering theory and quantum mechanics for scalar waves. Okay, so what do we want? We want the electric field, of course, it has an incident wave and the scattered wave. So what we want is the difference between the final electric field far away from the scatterer and the incident wave. We want that to look like outgoing spherical waves with some angle-dependent vector amplitude. So I'll write that as an amplitude, which is a vector. This would be a scalar in the quantum problem, which depends on the incident wave vector coming into the sphere and the incident polarization vector coming into the sphere and a spherical outgoing wave. Well, that may look kind of obvious, but that's going to be the crucial point in the next steps, that there is no term that looks like e to the, like an incoming wave. That clue is going to help us to choose these coefficients. We're going to choose them that kill this term. That's the whole logic. And the similar happens in the quantum. You kill the incoming spherical waves at infinity. Okay, so let's look at how that looks then. To do that, we want to look at the incoming wave, which I've said is a vector plane wave, but I want to rewrite it in spherical expansion. And that'll allow us to connect to those spherical expansions over there. Okay. So that's the next key step. Insert the spherical expansion of the incident wave. And I claim that we can use this expansion of the plane wave. I think we've written it a number of times, maybe even last time. for the two helicities. We did it for circular polarized waves of positive or negative helicity. And we could write this as the sum over L of I to the L constant square root of 4 pi 2L plus 1. And then there was the asymptotic form of JL, which has sine of KR minus L pi halves over KR times vector X and L plus or minus 1 is the M values, corresponding M values. And then there is plus or minus 1 over K, the curl term in this incident spherical wave, curl of sine kr minus l pi halves over kr, again from expanding the jl of kr at large r, xl plus or minus 1. So now I'm going to take that E over there, subtract this form of E incident, and impose the boundary condition to kill this incoming spherical wave at infinity. Sometimes these derivations involve a lot of writing, but you have to keep in mind the big picture as you're going through it. This is what we're doing. So, E minus E incident, still we don't know for the plus or minus helicity. A claim has the following form. Let's just write out explicitly the TE part. It's a sum over L of these constants DL plus or minus 1. Only the M equals plus or minus 1 are going to survive because our boundary condition only had plus or minus 1 in the incident wave. And we had spherical symmetry. There's nothing that would break that quantum number, if you let me use quantum language. You'll let me.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks. Okay. Okay, here's our phase-shifted general wave that includes the physics of the way of the dielectric sphere. And now we subtract from that the radial part over there, I to the L square root 4 pi 2L plus 1, and the sine kr minus L pi halves over kr all times xlm. Sorry, M is plus or minus 1. So that's the TE part of the wave. I won't write out all that for the TM part, but it's the same kind of stuff. All these TM terms, so on. Okay, well, we see sine waves. Sine waves have both incoming and outgoing spherical waves. So we're going to have to break up the sine waves, write those explicitly, and then zero out the incoming wave. And that'll tell us the constant DL. that will cancel out the incoming waves. Okay, so just to remind you, sine x is e to the ix minus e to the minus ix over 2i. We plug that in. I'm not going to bore you with all the algebra. I'll just tell you, and you will believe me, that dl plus or minus 1 for the TE modes, TE waves, in order to kill the incoming waves, has to equal this value, I to the L 4 pi 2L plus 1, 1 half, E to the I delta L TE. That will kill all the incoming waves in the top line. And then when we plug that back in to our formula, we can derive the scattered wave. After we plug in that value of TL, the coefficient of the outgoing waves I'll just write the TE part. We'll have e to the IKR over R. And skipping the algebra, a couple of lines gives this minus 1, minus I over K, sum over L, pi now times 2L plus 1 square root. And voila, we have something that looks like a quantum scattering matrix. Or minus 1 looks like a quantum transition matrix, if you guys have ever seen that. And I left out in my notes, you might add that, Mr. XL plus or minus 1. Forgot to write that in this line in the notes. So that's all the TE part of the outgoing waves that will reach the detectors at infinity. And then we'll have the TM terms that I'm not going to write out. But I will write out the TM terms of H, which looks similar. Remember the TM terms of E would have the curl type, curl of Bessel function times an XLM. But I will at least tell you that similarly, to kill the minus IKR over R in the TM terms of H, must have, this will lead to, again, after some algebra that I'm not going through line by line, because it'd be, I think, too painful for you. And almost too painful for me, plus or minus 4 pi 2L plus 1. But you know, you might go through this on your own. Just verify that you can get all these formulas. Then you'll know you understand it really completely. E to the I delta LTM. And then you plug that back in the TM formula, the H part of the TM formula, and you get H minus the incident magnetic field. We'll look at infinity in the far zone, like E to the IKR over R, only outgoing spherical waves, times minus or plus sum over L, a constant, epsilon naught over mu naught to the half, similar pi times 2L plus 1 that we had over there to the 1 half, e to the 2I delta LTM minus 1, which in quantum mechanics we call the transition matrix, or the scattering matrix minus the identity. And that's divided by k, and then there's an xl plus or minus 1. And then that's the tm part of the magnetic field scattered, and there will be then the te terms that contribute to h like a curl in h minus h incident, which I'm not going to write out. So that's really the main algebra and the main logic of this derivation, the killing of the incoming waves in the true field outside minus the incident wave. Now let's go to the observables, the things you will measure in the laboratory, if you are in the mood to send plain electromagnetic waves onto a dielectric sphere. And who isn't? All right, so there's some more algebra to derive things like d sigma, d omega. The differential scattering cross-section is a function of angle, and the integral of that, d omega, which will be the total scattering amplitude, and you can also get the differential cross-section with detection of polarization. And I think these formulas are given in the text, like page 474, equations like 10.61, how you just extract, look at the asymptotic power coming out, and divide that by the incident power coming in. And you'll get a cross-section. So, for instance, sigma, the total or the integrated scattering cross-section, I'll give that formula because it's kind of a nice simple formula that parallels the formulas you'll see in your quantum phase shift scattering treatment. This is often a quantity that's the most interesting, most important, is the integrated scattering cross-section, integrating over all angles. And that works out to be pi over 2k squared, sum from L. Remember, it doesn't start at 0 because these are vector waves. It starts at 1. 2L plus 1, you see the same factor in the quantum result, times the magnitude of this e to the 2i delta LTE minus 1 absolute square, plus the same for TM delta LTM minus 1 absolute square. So it does have dimensions of an area, as we expect for a cross-section in three dimensions, and everything else is dimensionless. This can simplify if we have real phase shifts, which we would have if we had real dielectric and magnetic constants in our sphere. to this form again, which should remind you, if you've ever seen the spherical scattering cross sections in quantum mechanics, this looks very similar to that. And don't forget the phase shifts are L dependent and they are K dependent too. Okay. That's the whole machinery of, if you really want to do exact scattering, and I know I do, this is how you do it. And actually, I thought I'd show you an example from the supplement I put in the supplement directory of me scattering resonances. So maybe I'll go back to the screen and show you what you can find in the real world. Yes, this is what I have to do. Guess I need this. That's interesting. There we are. Okay, so this is a paper I found. I checked this reference still works. And again, this is in the supplement directory if you want to actually try out this reference without typing it or snapping it now. Basically, they took layers, spherical layers of alternating silicon dioxide and silicon, which have different indices of refraction, different dielectric constants, and then basically solved for the scattering phase shifts as a function of wavelength or a function of frequency. Yeah, I guess this is a theoretical paper, I think. Actually, I don't remember now for sure. But yeah, basically nanoparticle, nano-size spheres of these of this type of construction. And then they calculate the scattering as a function of frequency in microns. And this is a very small range of wavelengths, from 1.51 to 1.59 microns. And you see all these resonances. Each resonance can be labeled as an individual TM or TE mode. And basically, if you calculate the phase shifts for every mode versus frequency, what you'll find is for one particular mode, you'll be coming along with a smooth phase shift, and suddenly it rises by pi over a very narrow frequency range. This is the resonance. And if you take d delta dE, it looks more or less like a Lorentzian peaked at that same wavelength. And the full width at half maximum is the decay width of the resonance. So that's pretty cool. You have the machinery to do that calculation yourself now.
So this curve was a theoretical?
I believe so. It's been a while since I looked at that paper. I think it's a theory prediction. Yeah. I thought it was pretty cool.
I really like that section in the middle, where you have those three spikes.
Or this region?
No, the first one that you played. Mm-hmm. I really like that one.
And so sometimes you see asymmetrical resonances, like funnel line shapes. that look kind of like the anomalous dispersion we saw back in chapter 7, where it's not a just a symmetric peak in the absorption, but it can be asymmetric like that. Well, you can see their higher angular momenta,
yeah. Oh, okay.
43 okay. units of angular momentum. So there's a big centrifugal barrier. That's how we would describe it in quantum mechanics. That makes it hard for the waves to really get in very much. So if you get in, basically the effective radial equation would, if you think of it as a potential energy, it has this huge barrier, and probably have to tunnel through this barrier, which controls the width. So yeah, I think it's probably generally true that the higher L resonances are the narrowest.
That's what it looks like.
This 42.
Yeah, a lot of the lower ones are pretty wide.
Mm-hmm. Although, yeah, actually, some of these big blobs, I wonder if they are very low L resonances. The general pattern, you mean? Yeah, though that might be very low L resonances themselves that are so broad they don't even bother to label them. I'm not sure. This would be a fun calculation to set up, but I haven't done that. I kept thinking I ought to do that one day. It's pretty straightforward compared to the kinds of quantum problems we solve. Okay, anyway, I think that's kind of a cool thing about me scattering resonances, and there are a lot of experiments on it too. I mentioned the name Schatz, just George Schatz at Northwestern, who has written a ton of papers on this and done more complicated things like bars or triangular kinds of or tetrahedral shapes and
scattering off of those.
Yeah, which now becomes a pretty big finite element calculation if you don't have spherical symmetry. But a lot of the same ideas carry over for setting up the theory. Okay, so much for scattering theory. Now I think we are ready for diffraction. Which is the last parts of this chapter 10 I'm going to cover. There's actually two sections. The first is scalar diffraction theory. So now we're talking about I'm going to mostly think about planar apertures in a plane that you come in with waves and then you look in the far zone at the electromagnetic fields and try to describe how apertures in a plane cause various interferences that can be observed at large distances. So let's start with, to set up the math, let's start with the Helmholtz-Green's function. VIKR over 4 pi r. And we're going to see in a minute, we're going to also need the primed gradient of G for the theory we're going to develop. So I'll go ahead and write that out right now. IKR over magnitude of R minus R vector over R squared and e to the IKR over 4 pi R. And remind you just a couple of general things. If we apply Green's theorem to a volume V, bounded by a closed surface S, then we can describe a solution of a scalar wave equation, scalar Helmholtz equation, namely del squared plus k squared psi equals 0. As follows, and we need a unit normal, you remember, on the surface. Then if we have no sources, and we just have, we'll have in the end, in a few minutes, an incident wave, and we will have no sources, but basically the surface from coming from the incident wave serves as the sources. We're going to have an inward normal. Usually when we do Green's theorem, we talk about the outward normal, like back in chapters 2 and 3. But I'm going to switch the sign for this discussion. And then we have this general formula that psi of x at any point in the volume of interest that's bounded by this closed surface S can be written as the integral over that entire closed surface. If you know psi of x and its normal derivative on that surface, you can do this integral psi of x prime n hat prime dot the primed gradient of g of x, x prime minus g of x, x prime times the normal inward normal component dotted into the gradient, the primed gradient of psi of x prime. Obviously to and integrate over the full area bounding our volume. That's our key starting point. I guess I even gave it an asterisk, this equation. No, I guess that's not the one I gave an asterisk to. I removed my asterisk. If we plug in this for prime gradient of G, we get a little simpler, more concrete expression. Psi of X is minus 1 over 4 pi. Closed surface integral e to the IKR over R, n hat prime dotted into the primed gradient of psi plus IK psi times 1 plus I over KR, and finally times R vector over R magnitude, dA prime. That's what I called equation star. And this is the formula we're going to apply to a couple of different scattering geometries. Okay. So one type of problem is radiation coming from source. Hits a screen that's a plane. That has apertures in it. So let me try to draw that. Okay, so here is a screen, and here are some apertures in it, just holes in the screen basically of some different shapes. Imagine this is perpendicular to the board. Incoming radiation is hitting this. And now we imagine extending this to large distances away and then making the surface go all the way around. And this is our volume V we're talking about. And we're going to be interested in from an origin somewhere in the middle of these apertures to a distance R where we'll maybe have a detector, essentially in the far zone. I'm going to call this incidence region 1, and this volume V region 2. And what this screen is just it has some plane with localized apertures. And we want to be able to move our detector around out here and see how the radiation is affected by having these apertures that can cause interference. So that's the first type. I'll call this part of the surface S, by the way, I'll call that S2. I'll call this S1. So our complete closed surface is both parts, S1 plus S2. But we'll treat them differently as they're kind of qualitatively different in character. Type 2 problem, you could also apply all this to another geometry where you have radiation comes from an inside volume. And passes through a surface S1 with apertures. And then causes a diffraction pattern and a bigger sphere in the far zone. So that looks something like this, like maybe have a closed surface S1 and radiation source is inside, sending out photons. And then there are some kinds of apertures here, and then on this outer S2, we'll collect the photons and maybe have detectors. And so this is our volume V is between these two surfaces now, and the total closed surface S is the sum of these two, both the inner and outer surface would make up the entire closed surface. So this is region 2, And this would be region 1 inside. Okay, so in both cases, light goes through S1, diffracts, and is detected at S2. Okay, so for both cases, the solution where you would have your detector should have this form. So I go to R equals infinity, which really just means the far zone. There should be some angle-dependent function if we are talking about scalar waves, scalar wave solution now. We don't need to keep track of vectors. We are expecting something like we had in scattering theory for the part of the waves diffracted off of these apertures. One thing that will be useful in our Green's function integrals later is the logarithmic derivative, 1 over psi d psi dr, which goes at large distance to ik minus 1 over r. Okay, so we're going to apply this integral that I've partly erased to this problem and use our Green's function to integrate over this. However, we will really do a closed surface integral like the integral says, except we're going to say this S2 part is giving nothing because the source is really coming in on and hitting only S1. We aren't going to have waves also that are coming sort of somehow doing that. We're neglecting that possibility because we're sending in the waves from one side only. Okay, so if we plug all that in, basically what we're going to use for the psi in these integrals is the incident wave. And I need to set up a couple of assumptions. First, we're going to assume that we can take psi and d psi dn in those surface integrals to be zero. Except in the aperture itself. And the second assumption is that we can use the unperturbed values of our incident from our incident wave for psi and d psi dn in those apertures. Now, Jackson at this point talks about the fact that had been stressed a lot back in chapters 2 and 3 of ENM1, that this is inconsistent to do this. It leads to mathematical inconsistencies. Essentially, th- this method, which is sometimes called the, I guess it's maybe always called the Kirchhoff approximation in optics. Basically, you have overspecified the boundary conditions. That's why we stressed back in chapters 2 and 3, especially when we talked about this, you should either do Dirichlet or Neumann boundary conditions. You should not really do both because your solution you'll find has inconsistencies. Like you'll say you did the integral that had these boundary conditions, but then if you go back and evaluate those boundary conditions, you'll find they aren't satisfied. Jackson also stresses that fixing this inconsistency does not actually fix very much about the theory. So we could just ignore it, or we could make a feeble attempt to fix the inconsistency and realize it's probably not going to matter. But it's easy to introduce a way to fix it. So let's go ahead and talk about that the way Jackson does. Okay. So basically, let's say a way to fix that is, let's say psi is known on the surface from our incident wave. Then we saw back in chapters 2 and 3, we ought to use Dirichlet boundary conditions. We ought to make a Green's function that is zero, and then there will only be terms in our integral that looks like d g dn times psi dA prime. And the other term will vanish that involves g on the surface times d psi dn. And conversely, if we were doing Neumann, we would make dgn dn prime either zero or a constant. But let's talk about the Dirichlet case. So that means GD of XX prime we make to be zero for all X or X prime on the surface. And then our solution will be, like I wrote here, be proportional to this integral X prime. And we can work this out for the special case of a planar screen pretty easily with apertures. That's the S1 part of S is a plane. And then the Dirichlet Green's function you can find just by the method of images. Can just make GD. I think this is plausible without doing a detailed derivation, which is equation 1084 of the text, that GD of XX prime that vanishes can simply be written as 1 over 4 pi e to the IKR over R minus e to the IKR prime over R prime. Let me set up the geometry for that. So we have our screen depth apertures. And we have our origin of coordinates at the center. Here's a vector x to the observation point. We have a, we're going to derive the volume in region 2 Green's function. And so we want to consider a point x prime in the volume, remember, if you remember back to chapter 2 and 3. And then r is the vector from x prime to x. And the idea of images is, well, there's another fake image on the opposite side that I'll call x double prime, an image source point on the other side. And now that has a vector r prime from that to our observation point. And that is equal to x minus x double prime. Okay, so that is clearly going to vanish if I take the source, as I'm going to do in my integrals, my Kirchhoff integral, I'm going to bring x prime back to the apertures. And then x double prime will also go to the apertures, and these terms will cancel. And this will obey the boundary condition of vanishing on the surface S1. So let's do a little bit further the algebra resulting from that. And I'm calling this the z equals 0 plane that has the apertures. So let's set this up. We will need the derivative on the plane, which is dgd dz prime at z prime equals 0. And of course r is x minus x prime squared, y minus y prime squared, z minus z prime squared to the 1/2. And r prime is all the same, except you have z plus z prime squared here. And so sparing you the algebra, this derivative we're going to need is k over 2 I pi e to the I k r over r 1 plus I over k r and n hat prime dot r vector over r. So this gives a formula, one as usual in physics. Solving this problem comes down to doing an integral. Psi of x will be k over 2 I pi integral over S1, which is an integral dx prime dy prime e to the ikr over r, 1 plus I over kr, n hat prime dot r over r, and times psi of x prime dA prime, where we will plug in our incident scalar wave. And I guess I called that double asterisk in the notes. So that's basically all you need to know about scalar diffraction theory. And my chalk has run low. But frankly, what is more interesting and important about the scattering of electromagnetic waves is not these differences between different ways to handle, like this Kirchhoff inconsistency, Jackson has, I think, an example comparing different ways of handling that inconsistency. Doesn't seem to matter all that much. But what's more important is really the vector nature of these waves. Vector diffraction theory is arguably more important. So that is our final topic in Chapter 10, is vector diffraction theory. But we can make use of what we have already developed, and basically we can apply our Green's theorem formula to each Cartesian component of like the electric field. That's still legitimate to do that, which will give a formula like E of x will be the surface integral, although again only over the S1 part of the surface that has the apertures. And then you have your E of x prime n hat prime dot into the primed gradient of g minus g times n hat prime dotted into the primed gradient of the different Cartesian components of x dA prime. And I'm only going to treat the planar case only, planar screen case, and plug into this, which gives, I guess, equation 10.101 for our diffracted wave at an observation point x, which will be I over 2 pi r. Can factor out the e to the ikr over r in the far zone. So I've already got the 1 over r. I don't need it twice. And now, skipping the algebra and going through the vectors and all that, it works to be k cross the S1 integral of n hat cross e of x prime e to the minus ik dot x prime dA prime, where we will again approximate this by e, the incident, the electric field in the incident wave in those apertures. So let's set up the geometry a little bit in pictorially. I'm not out of time, not quite yet. Okay, so we'll have our aperture in our plane. Imagine something like a circular aperture, for instance, maybe of radius A. And we'll have a vector k hat pointing to our detector. We'll have our incident waves coming in from the other side of the plane. We'll have from our origin a vector x prime to some little differential area in the aperture. So that little thing I wrote is meant to be x prime. And this little square I wrote is meant to be dA prime that we are integrating over. And n hat is z hat. Here is the normal directed into the observation side. So you could imagine maybe this is a metal, a conducting screen with holes in it. Well, in particular with one hole as I've drawn it. So we'll set up a coordinate system where k, we'll choose the incident k in the xz plane. So I can write k as the magnitude of k times z hat cosine of an incident angle alpha plus x hat sine of the incident angle. And then E naught will be a vector orthogonal to that. That will be our electric field vector minus z hat sine alpha plus x hat cos alpha. So I've picked the polarization in the xz plane. And then what we're going to do, I guess I'm out of time now, but let me at least write what we're going to do next time. We're going to plug in the incident field, which will look like E naught x hat cos alpha minus z hat sine alpha times our incident plane wave coming at not necessarily just on the z-axis, but we'll allow it to come in at an angle z cos alpha plus x sine alpha. And we'll plug that in. We'll do that integral and we'll talk for about a third of the lecture. And then we'll shift to relativity. So if you came in late, I mentioned that there's a new homework assignment posted with one mandatory problem and one optional problem for extra credit. And no, I don't have your homework yet. Did you say it's wrong? Okay, it's helpful to know that in advance. Almost not wrong. Okay.